From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mark Ruffalo tended bar for 9 years before getting dependable work as an actor. He was noticed by critics and audiences in the 2000 film You Can Count on Me, playing Laura Linney's troubled brother. His more recent films include Zodiac, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, In the Cut, and My Life Without Me. He stars with Joaquin Phoenix in the new film Reservation Road. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Ruffalo. Also, rock historian Ed Ward listens to a box set called Rockin' Bones that makes him wonder what rockabilly really means. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After theater roles and the small parts in films and TV episodes, my guest Mark Ruffalo was discovered by critics and audiences in the 2000 film You Can Count on Me. He played Laura Linney's troubled brother. He went on to star or co-star in such films as My Life Without Me, We Don't Live Here Anymore, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Collateral, and Zodiac. Now he's starring in the new film Reservation Road. It focuses on two fathers whose lives become entwined by a tragedy. Ruffalo plays a divorced father who loves spending time with his son, but can't get his life together. While driving back to his ex-wife's house, taking his son home after going to a Red Sox game, Ruffalo's car accidentally hits and kills a boy. It all happens so quickly, Ruffalo's son doesn't realize what happened. Ruffalo is so stunned and afraid, he just keeps driving. The father of the dead boy is a college teacher, played by Joaquin Phoenix. In this scene, after secretly thinking of turning himself in, Ruffalo shows up at his ex-wife's door. His ex is played by Mira Sorvino.
What is it, Dwight?
Tomorrow's the first day of the World Series. I want to take Luke for the week.
No, that's not what the court ordered.
Okay, can we just forget about the whole court thing for a minute? Lars doesn't care about the series. It's the Sox. When is that ever going to happen again? I just want to take him for the week. I'll get him to school on time, please. After that, I have to go away for a little while.
Jesus, Dwight, you're always running away.
Listen, you're always telling me that I gotta take responsibility for myself. Well, that's what I'm trying to do here, okay? Let me have him.
Mark Ruffalo, welcome to Fresh Air. The only thing your character really likes about his life is being a father. I mean, he really deeply loves his son.
Mm-hmm.
And his track record as a father is a little erratic.
Mm-hmm.
You're a father. Is it easier to play the role of a father being one? Do you think it would be more difficult for you had you not kind of experienced what it's like to be a father?
I may not have maybe responded to the role the way that I did. I may not have kind of ended up in this movie if I wasn't a father. I don't think it's such a particular experience. You know, I have a 6-year-old boy, and it just brings out a lot of questions and reflections on character, what it is to be a man. You are constantly sort of checking your behavior. You know that one day some scene is going to play out constantly in your child's memory. That's my experience. And you're also dealing with your baggage and your family experience. And it's something that actually has been passed down from generation to generation. It's not just your relationship with your boy, but your relationship with your father and his relationship with his father and so on and so forth. And so it sort of becomes a reflection on the work, you know. You're drawing on those things. And, you know, my child at the point of shooting this movie was really coming into, like, his cognizant idea of selfhood. And so a lot of these themes that are in the movie are sort of things that have been on my mind or you know, immediately relatable to me in my life right now.
I know sometimes actors take the role home with them, and their wives or husbands complain that they're
suffer.
Yeah, that they're a little too much like the character when they get home at night. That's something you really wouldn't want to happen as a father, probably, because your child wouldn't understand that it's the work, you know.
Yeah.
So, do you have to take like special care when you're playing a father, you know, a troubled mm-hmm. father, and you're coming home to your children?
I think any actor really worth their salt, no matter how you try to safeguard against it, gets affected by these people that you sort of come into contact with in a very kind of intimate and personal way. And they certainly have some chemical reaction on you as a human being. But I've been doing it long enough now that I can pretty much divorce myself from it. I can leave it home. Certainly, you know, certain aspects of it haunt you. But I do think it's important to take care that you have some continuity with your children. And and your wife, you know? And so, you know, I was on location for this for quite some time, and that actually worked out well because I didn't have to, you know, really step in and out, step in and out, step in and out every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's something that you have to. It certainly changes my choices as well. You know, as I'm getting older and the kids are getting older.
What about when you made In the Cut, which was a thriller that has
I knew you were gonna
yeah
go
that. That has a lot of like not only dark but kind of like overtones of sexual kinky stuff going on.
Yeah.
In it. And you're a kind of like ambiguous figure during a lot of the film. You know, like the mm-hmm. the viewer isn't really sure where you are, like who, mm-hmm. like where your mind is. Were you concerned about that then? Were you a father then when you made it?
Yeah. Well, that was a very kind of precious time in my life. I was kind of not acting for a little while, and I needed a job, and then here's Jane Campion, and it was something I'd never done. It was kind of was break me out of a certain type of youthful kind of characters that I was known for at the time.
Right. So instead of being the brother, you're the cop.
Yeah, so he's a man, and he's sexy, mm-hmm, and he's very open and forward about his desires, and it's something very, very far from me, and a great acting part, just like, you know, pretty fantastic acting challenge. And so, you know, there was a lot of, that was a difficult movie to do. Also one of the most kind of enriching movies for me as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find that the places where you are scary, that seem difficult, usually are the most kind of fertile ground for you to grow as an artist, you know? And so you're sort of constantly switching off of, you know, okay, yes, there's going to be some discomfort with this, but also these kinds of things really pay off high dividends when you're looking at it just as an artistic endeavor.
Well, why don't we hear a scene from In the Cut? And you know, there's this kind of like sexual mutilation murders taking place, and you're investigating them, and one of the body parts is found in front of a beautiful college professor's home, and in investigating her, you also become very flirtatious with her and, mm-hmm, and involved with her. Let's hear a scene, and she's played by Meg Ryan.
You don't remember anything, didn't see anything, didn't hear anything, no cries in the night?
No, I don't remember seeing or hearing anything unusual. And I sleep with the windows open.
Mm-hmm. You do that a lot?
Can you tell me how it happened?
Her throat was cut, and then she was disarticulated. Here's my card. My number's there if you remember anything. Give me a call, all right? Do I know you from someplace?
I don't know.
That's Mark Ruffalo and Meg Ryan in a scene from In the Cut. So what impact did this film have on you after Hours?
That was a really interesting time.
Well, let's explain a little bit, if you don't mind my mentioning it. This was a period, I believe this is the period, you had a benign brain tumor.
That's correct.
And had surgery for that, and had an extended period of recovery, and I think this was the movie you made first afterwards.
Yes, there was a movie called My Life Without Me with Sarah Pauly that I did just before this.
Mm-hmm, okay.
I had a sort of co-starring part in that, but it was really her film. And then this was my next kind of big jump back into acting after, you know, many months of, you know, these kind of side effects and complications from the surgery. And I was very nervous. You know, they go and they tinker around in your head and it leaves you slightly disoriented. And any illness, I think I could speak for a lot of people, it's when you recover from something like that, it leaves you a little... It sort of does a number on your confidence, and you see your sort of your mortality, and so I had fear that maybe I had lost my ability to act. After a brain surgery, you're kind of you're confused. It takes a long time. You know, some cognitive dysfunctions and all that sort of thing, and. I was very nervous, but also very desperate because you fall out of the Hollywood scene, and I really felt like I'd fallen between the cracks, and I was having a hard time getting work and even getting people to meet with me. And, by providence, I got a call from Jane Campion that at the time was casting in The Cut, and... You know, I'd put on 40 pounds from steroids that I was given to recover. And I went in and I met Jane Campion and talked about the script. And it ended up terrifying me, but I also felt very passionate about what I could do with it. And I was also very raw and desperate and kind of vulnerable. And she reacted to that. And then she basically, after 3 hours of discussing the part and arguing about the part in certain places, she asked me to do it.
You know, one of the things I imagine must have been strange doing the part after this period of recovery is, I mean, when you're not feeling well, you don't really want to be seen. You know, you feel vulnerable, you feel kind of broken, and you feel kind of, cut off from the rest of the world in some ways.
Yes.
And to go from that into like being on a large screen, blown up, supersized, with people paying attention to your every gesture, every eye blink, it's such a completely different frame of mind. It must be so difficult to go from the vulnerable recovery one to the like I am on screen version. Yeah.
Yes, thrust right into the world stage kind of. Yeah, and in a way, a lot of that actually worked for the part.
How?
I mean, he isn't a vulnerable guy, but there was something that was edgy and dangerous about me at that time, and very frightened. And a lot of that sort of, I think, manifested itself in that performance, which I'm really, that risk of sounding egotistical, I'm really proud of that performance,
Oh, you should be. It's a very good performance.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And so it meant so much to me on so many different levels that succeeded. It was sort of my chance to come back. It was a chance to break away from this my You Can Count on Me role, Terry Prescott, which kind of broke my career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, broke me out. It gave me a chance to prove myself as a man and to prove myself as a character actor, which is the tradition that I come from. It had an enormous amount of immediacy and almost a desperation about it that I think really sort of makes that piece special.
My guest is Mark Ruffalo. His new film is Reservation Road. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is Mark Ruffalo. He stars in the new film Reservation Road. His other films include Zodiac, Collateral, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and You Can Count on Me. When we left off, we were talking about his role as a police detective in the film In the Cut, which was directed by Jane Campion. You said In the Cut really changed your image from the way people knew you in your breakout role in You Can Count on Me. So why don't we hear a scene from You Can Count on Me and talk about that a little bit. Now, this was written by Kenneth Lonergan, who was a playwright and screenwriter, and you had worked with him before the movie. And
that's right.
You star with Laura Linney. You play two siblings who, as children, were orphaned when their parents were in a car accident. And you develop in very different waves. She becomes this kind of stable, single mother, you know, raising her child in as good a home as she can manage on her, you know, job in the local bank. Whereas you're really, like, troubled, you're lost, you're drifting, you're broke, and you're needy. And you come to see your sister for the first time in a long time. And this is a scene where you're meeting at a restaurant after not seeing each other for a long time, and you make a confession to her.
I actually got to confess to you, Sammy, that the reason that you may not have heard from me for a while is that I've been unable to write on the account of the fact that I was in jail for a little while.
You were what?
I served a little time, I guess, down in Florida. It was for bull.
What?
It was for bull.
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. Does it occur to you that maybe I was wrong?
No.
Well, could you please let me tell you what happened?
What happened?
I got into a fight in a bar down in Florida, which I was not the one who instigated at all. But then it worked up all this bullshit against me, and they threw me in the pen for 3 months. And I didn't write you because I didn't want you to get all upset about it. I just figured that you would figure I was on the road for a little while. It was stupid. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you worry. You know, but you want to know what? I can't run around doing stuff or not doing stuff because it's going to make you worry. Because then I come back here, I tell you about my f***ing traumas, and I get this wounded little I've let you down bullshit over and over again. It just cramps me. I just want to get out from under it. Yeah, back in this f***ing hole explaining myself to you again.
Please stop cursing at me.
I realize that I'm in no position to basically say anything ever, but it's not like I'm down there in some redneck bar in Florida. I'm having an argument with some stripper's boyfriend, and I suddenly say to myself, hey, this would be a great time to really stick it to Sammy and get myself locked up for a few months.
Hey. You don't write me for 6 months. I don't know where you are.
Sorry.
I don't know if you're alive or dead. And then suddenly you show up out of nowhere. You tell me you were in jail.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Sammy. I'm really sorry.
That's Mark Ruffalo and Laura Linney in a scene from You Can Count on Me. That's a really great scene. And that's also really early in your film career, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You just kind of captured a certain, like, you know, like defensive, lost, depressed kind of speech in that?
It's almost like it's an iconoclastic modern brokenness.
Modern brokenness, exactly. Can you talk about, like, getting to that place, doing that scene?
You know, it was introduced to me months, a year before, as a one-act play.
Oh.
That Kenny gave to me. I had no idea it was part of a movie. And we did it for a little one-act play festival. And I was so turned on by the material. It spoke to my youth, people I grew up with, a certain ennui and lost, these very clever, smart, sort of gifted kids who just lost belief. And I saw them all around me. And it was sad because they were in many ways stellar and also but somehow lost their heart along the way. And they were different than the kids who were straight A students and the really well behaved kids, like the perfect kids who were like the models at that time. And these kids were much more interesting, much more original, much more alive in so many ways, but had somehow lost faith somewhere along the way. And that was a big, I felt like a big part of my generation from where I came from, you know? And they were the punk rockers and the artsy people and so on and so forth.
Did you feel like you were in that category yourself?
I was sort of on the edge of it. I didn't have the sort of courage to rebel as loudly and deeply as they did. But I was in it enough to witness it. And all of those, you knows, you like, I mean, it's just, you know, all of that was written exactly as spoken exactly as Kenny Lonergan wrote it. He was a stickler for it. And he was able to capture a whole sort of patois of a certain aspect of my generation. Mm-hmm. And as I've traveled around all my travels, people are like, that was my brother. That's me and my brother. That's the way it seems like it's very American in its nature.
Mark Ruffalo will be back in the second half of the show. He stars in the new film Reservation Road. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Miramax Films, presenting The Hoax, starring Richard Gere. Available on DVD October 16th. From Carpenter Company, maker of bed pillows and other innovative products designed to help people sleep better. Z-score test and sleep tips available at carpenter.com. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Almanac of Political Corruption, Scandals, and Dirty Politics by Kim Long. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward listens to a rockabilly box set and wonders what rockabilly really means. Also, Mark Ruffalo on the slow start and nearly sudden end of his film career. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Ruffalo. He stars in the new film Reservation Road. His other films include Zodiac, Collateral, In the Cut, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, We Don't Live Here Anymore, and You Can Count on Me. You know, your career actually got off to a pretty slow start, right? You were a bartender for 9 years while you were trying to act. So what was one of the highlights of your bartending years? What was one of the most difficult incidents you had to handle?
I had a friend of mine start a fight in the bar, and it was mostly all the highlights were the bar fights. Really, those were sort of the man making moments of a pacifist, peace lover, peacenik like myself. I went into bartending very timid and very afraid, and I walked out of it a little bit more of a man.
What's a fight? Did you have to actually break up fights yourself?
I had to. I mean, one guy like really started to get physical with somebody, and I don't know why I did this, but I just, he was much bigger than me, and I really knew I basically grabbed his windpipe and dragged him out of the bar. And, you know, he was threatening to kill me and all these things, and it was really out of control, and it was terrifying to me. But I was, you know, it was just one of those moments where something else kicks in that's survival oriented, but it was horrible as well, and I didn't like that I did that, and I sort of, you know. And I didn't hurt him ultimately, but it did stop him immediately. And it stopped this whole what was turning into an incredibly ugly bar fight.
Did the fact that you could do that give you confidence that you could handle roles as, for instance, cops?
It opened up this thing that, I had... I could handle myself in that situation. I got into a fight when I was a little kid, and it must have only lasted a couple minutes, but it felt like an eternity, and I hated every second of it, and I was very terrified of confrontation from that moment on, and then here I am, as a young actor struggling, and closed down to. Fearful of confrontation, which all modern drama is based on,
right?
And I was able to sort of break through it, you know, and actually I felt like, okay, you know what, I have that in me. I mean, I can do that. I can play those parts. I could I can access that, you know.
So that bartender thing was a good experience for you in the long run.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, the whole bartending thing was the last place. You know, I'm reading, you know, I'm reading Rilke, and you know, and Pablo Neruda's love poems, and then going to this really rough and tumble bar every night, and doing a play. And passing out my little playbills, and you know, and with all these guys, some of them were heroin addicts, some of them were just like never read a book in their lives, you know, and here I was straddling these two worlds, and it was very tough. I mean, a guy got killed outside our door one night, a gangster, and there was some retribution. We were asked to wear bulletproof vests, and
gee,
you know, it couldn't have been. in many ways, a more of like a crash course in just the macho, manly world of testosterone.
I think you started a theater company, the Orpheus Theater, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Me and a group of young actors that I went to acting school with all got together, and we were at the Stella Adler Conservatory, and they had the school stage sitting empty every night, and so I went to the administrator and I said, listen, I want to start a theater company. We should be able to work out, you know, these tools that we've been given. And so we were given Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night on the stage. And that was kind of the beginning of what would be my Los Angeles theater career.
So what was the focus of the kind of theater you wanted to do?
We were doing mostly. We were doing some Chekhov. We did some. We did Long Day's Journey Into Night. We did some Tennessee Williams. They were kind of American modern classics. Some of them, and then we you know try and dabble with some Shakespeare. But a lot of it was the stuff that Stella was sort of teaching at the time, which. Was a lot of the American classics or world classics, modern classics.
It must be great to start your own theater company because that way you can, it's a small group and you give yourself parts. You decide what you want to do, and you give yourself parts. You're not dependent on somebody else to confer acting on you.
Exactly. And I could do a $5,000 production, a $2,000 production of Misalliance, or I could do a $2,000 production of Waiting for Godot, no one came.
But you got the experience.
Yes, but I got to play some of the greatest parts for a young actor in the history of world theater. So that was, you know, I worked it out on a stage in front of a very, 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 very small group of people.
My guest is Mark Ruffalo. His new film is called Reservation Road. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Ruffalo, and he's now starring in the movie Reservation Road. You know, a little earlier when we were talking, You Can Count on Me and In the Cut as being the movies that you made after emerging from an extended period of recovery after having surgery for a benign brain tumor. Would you mind if I just asked you a couple of questions about that period?
No, shoot.
What were some of the things you had to regain when the surgery was over?
Well, certainly balance was immediate. I lost my hearing in my left ear, and so my balance was completely shot. So I was falling. It was actually comical. I was just falling down all the time for the first couple of months. Walk a few steps, fall down. And then, you know, every hour you're under anesthesia, they say it's a month of recovery, so that's 10 months right there. And they say you have cognitive dysfunctions, which, you know, can be simple things like finding your way home from one side of Washington Square to the other, which I got lost doing one night.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of abstract sort of processes, these kind of abstract creative ideas seem to get a little muddled as well. So there was a time of kind of getting myself back, you know, getting your sense of self, sense of independence, sense of, I had to completely basically give my life over to my wife at the time.
What about things like facial expressions that are so important when you're acting?
Well, I had during the course I had of recovery, my face miraculously became paralyzed on the left side of my face, and no one seemed to really know exactly why that was happening. They pretended like they did for a little while, and then slowly but surely I caught on to the fact that they had no more of an idea than I did, and they tried a bunch of different things, and it didn't seem to be coming back. And, you know, there was some speculation that it wasn't going to come back at all, or it was only going to come back 20-30%. And as an actor, just starting my career, that was pretty devastating news with a newborn and recently married and everything ahead of me in so many ways. And so a big part of the recovery was praying, hoping, going to healers, doing all kinds of therapies.
Did the tumor and the period of recovery force you to change certain patterns of behavior or ways of acting that you wouldn't have otherwise given up, but in the long run, like, you're happy you were forced to change?
Yeah, I mean, I was someone who's always prone to deep, deep depressions, and those seem to come to an end. I mean, the length of them certainly did. That's something that I'm very grateful for. Also,
but you don't get them anymore?
I get them, man. Believe me, I get them. But I don't slide down the well the way I used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to appreciate acting in a way that I didn't really understand what it meant to me at that time.
What does it mean to you different now than it did earlier?
It's kind of my way to be fully realized as a human being. I feel like, you know, it's my relationship to the world that is that's just gonna you know, make my life sort of as full as it could possibly be.
Were you afraid after you recovered that other, like, casting directors wouldn't believe that you were fully recovered and they'd be afraid to hire you?
I heard someone was like, we heard you had AIDS. We heard you were in rehab. We heard you're an alcoholic. I mean, it just went on and on and on. And, yeah, I mean, you're damaged goods. I even today I don't like to talk about it, but because it's you, Terry, I will.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Because I know you'll handle it well. There's a perception in our culture where if you're ill, you're damaged. You go to the damaged goods box,
mm-hmm.
with the misfit toys, and that was frightening to me. And I also people sensationalize these things into making it, oh, it's the actor with the brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not the actor with the brain tumor. I'm much more than that, and any person who's been ill is much more than simply their illness. So, it took a long time it didn't take as long as I thought it was going to, but it took a long time to sort of get back into the groove that I was in before the brain tumor.
You know, I've noticed that there's, I wouldn't say this about Reservation Road, but there's some roles that you've had in the past few years that are more kind of like the existential guy, the guy who, you know, I'd say this maybe even about like Zodiac, you know, the detective that you play. Mm-hmm. He's kind of obsessed in everything, but there's a distance from emotion, a fatalistic quality, accepting that life is dark and difficult. And that's just the way it is.
Well, someone who's much brighter than me, and I'm going to rip off his quote, the joyful participation in the sorrows of the living. That's Joseph Campbell. And, I don't know why I see that. I have a lot of empathy for the human race,
mm-hmm.
and its march through time. And its connection to suffering and hardship and difficulties, as well as joy and, you know, the beautiful things in life. And there's something very poetic to me about that. And so maybe I'm attracted to that when I see it. You know, it's something that I'm always slightly aware of. You know, there's just the epoch nature of our existence. You know, that spans many, 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 many decades, centuries, where the human experience is universal, universally sort of riddled with difficulty and exaltation and so part of me poetically sees that, so maybe that's I admire it and revel in it in a way, and so maybe that's, you know, maybe that's what you pick up on in the, mm-hmm. in some of the work, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's just a completely different question.
Okay.
I know your mother is or was a hairdresser, and you have a couple of siblings who became hairdressers.
Yeah.
So
when
you're getting, like, your hair and makeup done for a role, can you converse with the person doing it on a real, like, technical level because you grew up with it?
They hate me. because I'm like, okay, you know what? Get the thinning shears out. I'd go with the quarter inch thinning shears here, right up in here. Just a little. Actually, can I just give them to me? I'll do it. And I mean, I know they hate me, and you know, it would be like me giving people line readings. I think a director giving an actor a line reading. I grew up in it. I watched it. I've been around it. And I've had many, 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 many haircuts. So it's kind of funny. I know when I work on a movie, I end up at some point cutting my own hair to everyone's horror. You know?
What movies have you done your own hair for?
I cut my hair for In the Cut.
Uh-huh.
I cut my hair for Eternals. The more
you had a mustache on In the Cut too.
Yeah, that's right.
Was that your idea? Was it?
Yeah, well, I wanted it, and there was a lot of fighting going back and forth between Jane and the producer. Like, nobody likes a man with a mustache, and I was like, he has to have a mustache.
Why does he have to have a mustache?
I was hiding behind it, you know. Uh-huh. It was my disguise, I think, to get it to be able to inhabit that guy without being self-conscious, I think. Maybe.
So you think you needed it more than he needed it?
Probably, yeah. And then Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is a pretty wild hairdo. I cut that too. I mean, and eventually someone else comes and cleans up the mess I make. But those are some.
Well, Mark Ruffalo, it's really been great to talk with you. I really like your acting.
Too.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Terry. It's a real pleasure and honor to talk to you.
Mark Ruffalo stars in the new film Reservation Road. It opens October 19th. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward plays some rockabilly music that makes him wonder what rockabilly really means. This is Fresh Air. Rockabilly is a term just about all rock and roll fans are familiar with, but after listening to Rhino Records' box set Rockin' Bones, rock historian Ed Ward has begun to wonder what it means or if the term even makes sense.
A pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. And now, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I wanna play house with you.
Everybody knows what rockabilly is. It's what we just heard, Elvis singing Baby, Let's Play House. It's got a stuttering vocal, a guitar line by Scotty Moore in this case, which is based on Merle Travis's pioneering style, and lyrics taken from the blues in the You May Go to College, You May Go to School verse. Oh, and it's also dirty, playing house, as in You Be the Mommy, I'll Be the Daddy, and Let's Make Babies. But I've wondered about rockabilly since the 1970s, when Bob Christgau at the Village Voice had me review a stack of British single-label rockabilly compilations with names like King Rockabilly and Decca Rockabilly. There were usually a couple of tracks on these records which merited the term, and the rest of the record would be taken up by second-string country artists who were, they thought, catching a ride on this new rock and roll fad. Among other things, that's a perfect description of Bill Haley, a rock and roll pioneer with no staying power. But it doesn't describe a lot of artists who get labeled rockabilly. Ronnie Dawson, for instance.
Yeah. after I'm gone. Whoa!
Dawson was a Dallas teen with a bleach blonde flat top haircut and a solid appreciation for blues. So solid, in fact, that he also recorded this under the name Commonwealth Jones. Whatever that is, it sure isn't stereotypical rockabilly. Another element that enters into these songs is teenage fads and the hope that the singer can grab a hit by singing about them.
Don't mess with my dog tails. Don't mess with my dog tails. If you mess with my dog tails, I'll get so mad at you. You gotta jump like a jumper, move like a moo cow, bob like a bobcat, but don't mess with my dog tails. My duck tails. If you mess with my duck tails, I'll get so mad at you.
Joe Clay was obviously taking his cues from both Carl Perkins, warning about his blue suede shoes, and from Elvis, with the stutter and the Merle Travis guitar. And if you ask me, I'd say he was definitely rockabilly. But most of the singers who recorded songs like this didn't understand the culture they were singing about and were immediately identified as the posers they usually were. Then, of course, there's sex. This was the big fear about rock and roll, that it encouraged lascivious behavior. And some of the records were, it's true, really over the top in this department. Did John and Jackie, whoever they were, seriously think this was going to get on the radio? Most records weren't that overt, of course, but it didn't mean they didn't smolder.
Woman love, hey, 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 woman love, hey, 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 woman love, hey, 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 woman love, hey, 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 hey. Well, I went to my doctor not so long ago, walking in the circle, I'm only known. He looked at me and said, good Lord above, son, you need a vaccination of a woman. No, well, I'm looking for a woman, one track mind, and I'm switching all the time. I'll be her kissing to the moon above, cause I sure am needing me some woman love.
That's right, once!
Gene Vincent's whole career revolved around records like Woman Love, which rarely got very far, but made him a legend for future generations. The main element which binds these records together, though, isn't stylistic, as much as it's that they all contain elements which threatened the way things were. Instead of rockabilly, I'd just call them rock and roll, which most people thought had descended on them like some sort of alien plague from outer space. Billy Lee Riley obviously agreed.
Well, the news of the songs have been flying around. I'm the only one that's seen it over the ground. First thing I seen when I saw it land, the cast jumped out and they called the band.
It was also a secret club. Very few of the records on Rock and Bones were played even on regional radio stations. The performers were local heroes for the most part, but they were inciting a rebellion and never thought for a moment it might become the status quo.
Our rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The music he played is from the box set Rock and Bones. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Ian Chillog, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm a tip-top daddy, and I'm gonna hide my way. Keep away from the corners, hear what I got to say. Hold on one hand only, get the ready for a ride. Give me one hand loose and I'll be satisfied. Give me free hand, baby, cause I wanna rock. Turn it loose in, baby, I won't blow my top. Give me free hand warm and let it swing up my side. Give me one hand loose and I'll be satisfied. Hello. Crowd me close, baby, this time is for real. Get ready for some rocking, pick them up and cut them down. Give me one hand loose and I'll be satisfied. Give me free hand, baby, cause I wanna rock. I turn it loose in, baby, I won't blow my top. Give me free hand, baby, let it swing by my side. But give me one hand loose and I'll be satisfied.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, starts Friday, October 12th in select theaters. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the band Radiohead made headlines by allowing their fans to download their new album In Rainbows through their website for whatever price listeners deem fair, all without the aid of a record label. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Radiohead's leader, Thom Yorke. Join us for the next Fresh Air.